I don't know how to play, and I don't want to anyway. Need to delete this game and go back to another save. But my hard drive sparked zero charisma, zero luck. I don't have any skills or the XP to fix my.
Hello and welcome to the National Institute for Gamer Review. I am DK.
I'm Lewis, and consume Siege product. Get excited for next Siege product.
Indeed, indeed. Yes. We wanted to do, we're doing a two for, I don't know how I'm going to update it. I'm going to upload it exactly. But we wanted to separate the Mario thing, which is just going to be its own thing, versus this is a very time sensitive discussion of the current ongoings in Ukraine, or in the Ukraine, and it's been a while since we've discussed. I don't think we've discussed the war since before the fall of Bakhmut. Do I have that
correct? This is kind of my take I've been saving, is that the only battle that's mattered in the last, like, I think, I guess since they retreated from Kherson, was the commando raid, or not raid, or commando assault on Soledar. And the whole front, after they made that big bulge into Soledar north of Bakhmut, has just been the front line kind of reorienting on that new ground.
100% agree.
The battle of Bakhmut didn't happen. It was just the lines were rebalancing around.
It was just the battle of Soledar. Yeah, exactly. It was the consequences of the battle of Soledar. It was already a fade out complete once the once Soledar had been taken. No, that's exactly right. And now we're witnessing, like, I guess the next actual development.
Okay. Nothing's happened since Soledar. Bakhmut falling has not changed anything. The new offensive, we talked about this, this reserve NATO tier or NATO aspirant brigade. And we thought, oh, they're going to use them in some way. And they ended up using them in one of the ways they possibly could, which was Zaporozhye. And it doesn't seem to be going well.
I want to back up for a second, but just to maybe reframe what I said, because, yeah, it's not that I think that this, I don't think that this so-called offensive ever had, or counteroffensive or whatever. I mean, it's an offensive, not a counteroffensive. The lines have been static for a while. But I don't think it ever had any chance. I don't think it has any chance. And it, certainly the way it's played out in the first 72 hours or so, you know, we're on track for it to just do absolutely nothing. So it's not that I think there's going to be, it's not that I think that it's a development in operational terms exactly. I think it's more of a development in political terms in like, this is a kind of, it's not exactly a hot take or original to me, but that this is essentially a political decision, not a military decision. And it's, you know, the move that's being made in the battle space of like fifth generational warfare is not a like operational, strategic, tactical type move. It's a political move in a bid for greater degree of Western NATO involvement. And I don't think it's going to work. I don't think that is going to work either. But I do think there's a piece on a chessboard, on a four-dimensional chessboard that's being moved. But it's not being moved in the two-dimensional. You know, it's up or down, right? Not left or right.
I have a slightly different take that they're just like pissing a brigade into the guns of, you know, Zaporozhye and these minefields.
Well, I think they intended to succeed. We'll get there in a second. But yes,
I think they sincerely they were
huffing their own copium.
No, they were doing, I think, like fourth generational warfare, right? Where they were doing these things, like all these raids into Russia, right? They have now twice before. Remember before this, they have launched two offensives where they basically the Russian army didn't show up.
Yeah.
Really badly didn't show up. And I think that there was a legitimate expectation that if we can pull off, you know, a certain amount of the frontline troops into other places with other, you know, fixing actions, you know, when we push somewhere, there won't be too many. Because, like, tactically, people, I've seen people say, oh, well, tactically, this is retarded. They're just throwing armored vehicles down a road and hoping. Well, first off, that's worked twice for them now. Like, you just take, like, armored pushes take losses. That's part of the game. It took losses in Kherson a little bit. It took pretty heavy losses in Kharkov, but they still basically took it all. And also, that's what, like, good tactics look like. Like, a World War II push looks identical to this. It's just you have a lot more stuff because it's World War II. Like, Zaporozhye would have been, like, a divisional plus objective with, you know, 30,000 guys all pushing down a road in vehicles, and they probably would have broke through. Like, if they could do what they've done.
30,000 Russians on the other side. I mean, I think there's at least a Russian division. Seems like I don't know if that the Russians are necessarily outnumbered.
Well, I don't know how many Russians there actually are versus how many.
It's hard, like, to say. That was what I wanted to say about
defending in a zone, yeah, kind of thing. But I think it's the reason they're doing all this bullshit in these raids into Russia proper, they were trying to just, in a very traditional way, trying to get the Russians to recommit forces.
Yeah.
And then, but I think the Russians called their bluff. And
I actually have a slightly different. Okay, sorry. Go on. I want to finish your take, and then
that's all I had. I think there's probably not, because they're so well built, there's probably not that many Russians in the defense as we anticipate. I think they are able to move around trench lines and mine, because the Russian narrative is that they haven't taken an inch of ground, and they've taken some ground. They've taken
500 meters. They've taken some fighting pits. They haven't everywhere.
I've seen estimates that are higher, and you know, could obviously be, the maps, I mean, and the movements, but like, I think they've taken like. This is also not
they've
a bad.
They've taken some on the flanks of Bakhmut, but I haven't seen them take.
I've seen the map. I've seen mappers that I trust have moved maps, you know, more than a kilometer. But I think
we'll get that. Let's let me back up for a second, because I want to. I think you're very right to compare. I think your interpretation of their operational theory is correct, in that twice before. The Russian army essentially melted away rather than give battle. The thing is, like, that's a dumb operational theory, not so much because it's purely in terms of, like,
let me hit you with why I forgot, but that's why I think there's less Russians in Zaporozhye than we think. I think there are comparable numbers of Russians in Zaporozhye that there were in Kharkiv.
No, there was a bare skeleton force in Kharkov before the.
But I
think Kharkov,
I think,
not in Kherson. In Kherson, there was like it was basically a full core, like 25,000 or so. In Kherson.
I think they are. They know how many Russians there are. I think the Russians are able to, with planning and foresight and intelligence, basically behave much more.
So one explanation that I heard,
maybe there's not as many as Kharkiv had, like, very few, and they were. And they were all lower quality, lower equipment. They were
territorial guards. They weren't, yeah.
Yes, I think now you're seeing, because it's Zaporozhye. These are Russian regulars, and you know, also Donbass regulars too. But you're seeing Russian regulars with Dougie. Like, everything is I think if the guys in Kharkiv had known, like, there would be an attack in a month or 2 months or whatever, and they could have
done similar.
They could have probably done similar stuff. Like,
yeah,
when you know the enemy's coming,
you know where and roughly when.
Yeah,
yes.
And I think
that's the first mistake, and that's the main reason why I'm definitely on team. This is a political, not a military decision, but or not, you know, primarily. But what I wanted to say, which doesn't, whatever. There's room for these things to be kind of overlapping. In their truth for the most part. I think, first of all, that the raids on Belgorod that was into Russian territory that we've seen, I don't think they were intended to be suicide charges. I don't know that they necessarily had particularly high expectations of success or
I don't know how many losses they even took. It was always like just it's kind of just showing the flag. They took some losses. The Russian narrative that they killed all those guys is probably not true.
You think they withdrew?
Yeah, obviously. They weren't like The idea that that was like a bite and hold mission, it was retarded. They were going there, showing the flag. Yeah,
right. But I don't think it was so much to like faint in the direction of a...
To demand that the Russians garrison those towns.
I don't even think... Yeah, but the problem is, and I could be wrong, but from what I saw, and again, could be wrong, maybe you have a different interpretation. From what I saw, because yeah, okay, they didn't maybe kill all of them, but they definitely, I mean, there was like several dozen, that, you know, there were videos of quite grisly coming out of that action. I don't think they intended that to happen. I don't think they expected that to happen. I think they expected there to be a skeleton force. And okay, obviously it's not going to be as heavily manned as the southern border or the eastern border, but I think basically this question that we've been asking for several months to maybe really just almost where are these 300,000 mobilized from Russia? I think they're not all. It's not just that they're not all in theater. It's that Russia has used that manpower to establish strategic depths along the entire line of contact and across the entire border. That there is no area, there is no rear area that is not absolutely swarming with Russian units. And that, yeah, well, it's certainly possible that they've baited. One explanation that I heard, or one theory or whatever you want to call it, that makes sense. I don't know if I buy it, but it fits with what you're saying for sure, is that that Russia had essentially a certain number of mobile reserves further back that were unexpectedly by the Ukrainians moved up to meet the advance, and that they're conducting a very sophisticated mobile defense that yes, whereas in general terms though that very far front area is somewhat by necessity also is going to be more sparsely populated than that big strategic bulk in the middle, but also like that the Russians are bringing more manpower to bear at the thrusting points, and that's combined with the minefields and the pre-sighted artillery, et cetera, and especially I think one of the big stories of the past 72 hours that this has been going on is that Russian aviation is essentially completely unchallenged. I haven't heard any claims from the Ukrainians about having shot down even any helicopters, to say nothing of any jets. So, I mean,
that said, there hasn't been much footage of CAS. It's always been like longer range.
There's been lots of talk. There has been some footage. There hasn't been a whole hell of a lot. That's true. I've seen some, but yes.
Yeah.
Combat air support.
A lot of it is they have now long range plane based missiles that are launching from
manpad range.
Or even S-300 range, right? Or right. Patriot range.
Or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Or whatever's on the front line. Yeah. Which also brings up the biggest story is less so, I think, about like the glide bombs or whatever, and more about that there's no more S-300 missiles in Ukraine. That's a pain. That's a possible pain point. Is like,
I don't think we've talked about it on air at all. Okay. And yes, we were discussing, you know, possible.
What are the actual pain points for Ukraine?
Because you and I are, you know, there's some disagreement with other people, which is fine. You and I, I think, are in total agreement that Ukraine is they're functionally unlimited warm bodies. Unfortunately,
many Kalashnikov, many RPGs, many bodies. Like
they will take them a very long. They will run out of territory before they run out of bodies.
Just by the math, they've only mobilized roughly 6% of their population. Historically, you can go 10% is like the rule of thumb. Nations in the past during World War II have pushed it beyond that into 12, I believe 14. I think the Soviets might have hit 16 at one point, but it was briefly. But I think with an older demographic, you might say, okay, maybe it is 10 or 8. Even if you assume it's 8, which is much, much lower, Ukraine has plenty of casualties, people to mobilize, plenty of casualties to give. That's a lot. Those are very big numbers. There's small arms and small support weapons.
And there's artillery shells. This don't fall for the meme that they're running out of ammo. I don't think they have many missiles generally. They certainly don't have, they are completely out of S-300 air defense missiles and the production pipeline for the Western systems is so limited. I don't even know that they would, like, their burn rate would be sustainable even at like projected increased targets of manufacturing for like 2024, 2025, which are entirely hypothetical. And I don't buy for a second that they're going to actually be able to meet those targets. But even if they did, they would, Ukraine would still be fired. You know, the these systems are so technologically complicated and so expensive. You're talking like hundreds of missiles where the Ukraine needs tens of thousands.
Yeah. I think also the issue with the West, so Eastern air defense systems are basically done. There's just no more missiles for them, or there's so few and so few launchers that they're just like it's a supplement. It's not its own thing anymore. But I think we are probably underestimating how much, even myself, like there's like the same thing happens with there's a lot of damn near expired or old like Western systems. If things get really bad, like you will see them pull stuff at like IHawks and stuff out of inventory. A lot of the countries keep that stuff. Your war game Red Dragon deck is still in inventory somewhere. So I think
there's the biggest issue is that kind of stuff. Yes, but how useful is that going to be against like? I mean, Iskanders, right?
I mean, like I said, that stuff is made to shoot down. Like I said, you train with that stuff even then, shooting down short-range missiles. Yeah. So, like, I think there will always be some kind of air net. There will always be some kind of military-looking vehicle Ukrainian troops are getting in and out of. You know, it's Max Pros right now and Humvees. Soon it's going to be Bradleys. The M113s are still around. Like, there will have... I don't think you're ever going to see no kind of air defense at all. I think it'll be like where we are now, where Russia can overwhelm them by sending 40 plus drones and hit what they need to hit. That's going to be the norm. You know, they just can't put enough, because you need to put up like 2 to 4 missiles to intercept. And the Ukrainians just can't put up, you know, 40 times 4 missiles. They just can't.
And Russia is also increasing their drone production. Lancet, as it's designated, is a huge hit. Literally and figuratively, and they're just pumping them out, and will continue to do so at just whatever rate they. Yeah. That's the thing is about Russia and China never deindustrialized. They were the recipients of the manufacturing of, especially China, of course, of American deindustrialization and European deindustrialization, and what they don't. What they don't, you know, what Russia needs, they can't make themselves. They can acquire from Iran and or China, which they're already doing. And I guess there's some question over. There's been some diplomatic back and forth over China's role, and China denies that they're supplying weaponry, and they have yet to be formally. There's been some sort of.
Frankly, I think they might actually not be.
That's my read on it as well. I don't think
they're
playing middleman, but not like actually directly.
My indicator there is that they're still selling like quadcopters to people that aren't Russia.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like, that's a very meaningful supply to Ukraine. Yes. So in light of that, I think
I don't remember all the details and it doesn't really matter. There has been some back and forth but basically like accusation, like there was some kind of special carve out because some Chinese company was doing some kind of business with some kind of Russian company, and then they were getting, the Chinese company was getting some kind of special exemption from the sanctions because they also did a bunch of business with a bunch of European companies, and so there's stuff like that. I
know there was some dual use stuff, like you know dual use,
like the quadcopters, quadcopters are civilian. What are you talking about?
Yes, you know, it's for photography, aerial photography, right? You know, But, you know, I don't think China, I don't think China's really a factor. I think it's basically just Russia versus whatever. And I don't think, like, I do not see a future where, like, Russia is like, oh my God, we're out of shells. We're out of artillery shells. Also, like, it's not happening. And also, both Russia and China have no desire to, like, Russia doesn't want to like help test new Chinese gear. That's not like how they do things. It's an actual big war, and the Chinese don't want to reveal any of their hand at all. So, I think it's relatively unlikely that the Chinese get involved in any real capacity. especially when there's still like so many. They want to have. I think what this war has shown us is that like you can adjust to new things relatively quickly. Like the HIMARS are basically. This is my biggest thing I want to talk about is that the HIMARS missiles and like long range missiles broadly, even for the Russians, both sides are suffering from not a lack of missiles, but a lack of like good targeting intel. And when they
get good
targeting intel, the Russians have enough missiles to punch through. And obviously they hit like those huge ammo dumps. Like they hit like five of those. And you're kidding yourself if you don't think there's not equivalent Russian ammo dumps, but they're just far enough east that HIMARS and other missiles have been seen enough that they can be confidently intercepted. Like the range of the HIMARS is not the max range as advertised by the manufacturer. Like max effective range is decreased as you spend more time in Russian controlled airspace and can be shot down. Right. So the actual like band of the, from the front line to the middle line, or what would you call it, of where you can actually effectively engage things with the HIMARS is relatively small. And like that issue with that infantry company was like all in one building together. The reason that was so bad is because that was inside the band.
That was like 15 kilometers from the front. It was basically right there. I mean, it was, you know, not at the zero line, but
when you have data in that red zone, and I think that like what do you call that reds, that strikeable zone for the Russians is much bigger because for them it's not strikeable. It's just like, okay, so the deeper we get into Ukrainian territory, into their back line, the more missiles per target we need to send. Whereas the Ukrainians seem to have a cap they can send at any one time anymore, which is like, it's hard to get a read on it, but like 8, maybe 12. And you can engage 8, maybe 12 HIMARS actually relatively effectively. The Russians are saying they can jam them too, which is a little more doubt. I don't know how well you can jam.
Their electronic warfare systems, I think you're right to be skeptical.
This, yeah.
But I think you're right to be skeptical, but I do, it does seem to me that they are, they were known before this was a priority for them, right?
Yeah. But also, so, when you look at a GPS-guided missile, how much of it, most of that mathematics and calculations and course correction is done relatively early in the missile. Well,
that's why they used to have gyroscopes, right? Too, right, as they have built in, you know. Yeah, I get what you're saying, but there's
it would be extremely impressive if they could be, because you would not just need to be blocking GPS from talk, like the satellites to the missiles is blockable. That's very proven. It's just juice, right? My issue would be they'd have to be feeding the missile garbage. Like they would have to be spoofing that they are the GPS satellites and be giving it like trick. They need to be like, they need to spoof it. And spoofing is a lot harder than jamming.
Yes. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
And yeah. I find it very hard to believe that.
Well, there seem to have, again, could be just PSYOP. I don't know. But I've seen a bunch of photos and videos of intact, recovered Ukrainian drones, like fixed-wing strike drones, so they're like essentially Russians are landing these drones like you would, like an RC airplane.
You could be made up. Achieve that with jamming as well. Like if you jam something, it can't go home. It just will fly until it runs out of gas and will land instead of crashing. Like that's an automated behavior. Like it knows what its output is.
Oh, is it? Okay. I didn't know that.
All yeah. Right. Most, yeah. I mean, for most of the drones that, you know, I've ever interacted with. So like if you jam a drone out and just confuse it, it will, if it can't
even land. Okay. Okay. Then I take that back. All right. Yeah. Good to know. Thank you for that.
It's drones don't like to crash. They really hate crashing. Because like as a manufacturer, like, if one thing you know is I don't want my expensive drone with its explosive payload to like, you know, become
just nosedive into a mountain. Yeah.
Yeah. Or just become an EOD problem. But no, I think the claims are very, the reason I don't think the Russian EW is really, really good is because they have a shitload of their own drones up making footage. Like there's a lot of, if the Russians were going like full blackout against Ukrainian drones,
they wouldn't have their own.
the odds of their own stuff being so it's so hard.
No, I know what you know. What so I was studying up on I'm still like I want to do more, but I really one thing that I've learned from this war I'm now like this is going to be my hottest gamer take ever maybe is actually you can learn more about analyzing warfare. I don't know about more, but you can learn pretty much what you need to know by playing well done war games. Like I just the amount of experience that I have, which is I'm not even like the world's biggest armchair general by any stretch. I've been playing them a long time, and I do tend to enjoy more kind of intricate simmy type things. But I don't have, you know, some people have like tens of thousands of hours. I don't have anything remotely approaching that. But you can absolutely learn quite a lot from a real well done war game. And so I used to really enjoy the old combat mission games, which were primarily World War II, or that was the original thing. And I never really got that much into modern warfare. It for a lot of reasons, it just didn't felt a little too close to home in certain ways. It was just, you know, it's easier to kind of mythologize about ancient or medieval or warfare, and in some ways emotionally, at least for me, World War II kind of feels it's just a distant enough past, and that it's like it's modern. The basics are the same, right? But there's a kind of emotional distance that could be had versus something like Combat Mission Black Sea, which is the their hyper modern, you know, literally it was a 2017 release of basically this conflict, this precise conflict, just about. And so I've been you know trying to acclimate myself more to the modern warfare combat mission setting. And one of the first big huge differences between the Black Sea and the Beyond Overlord, there, you know, the World War II era rules, you know, machine guns, armored vehicles, sight lines, all that kind of shit works pretty much the same. One huge difference is UAVs and electronic warfare stuff. And the way electronic warfare stuff is modeled is basically it's the same for both sides. Like if you know, conditions are such that you electronic warfare condition is like low, you know, off to mild, then yeah, you can fly UAVs and they're pretty much unobstructed for everybody. If it's, you know, moderate to high, then yeah, you don't get UAVs, but neither does the other guy. And that's just kind of, that's just the, I mean, it's literally like in the manual, that's the rule for electronic war. It's just like a gauge on the battlefield conditions that you set, you know, before, you know, as part of the setup or whatever. So yeah, just to kind of,
yeah. Put so it in, just to give an example of like how the ideal looks is in Iraq, there are basically these devices. There's a lot of names. Most people use probably Thors, where it's a cell phone, a jammer for the whole spectrum, but it's made to jam cell phones that it prevents you from phone calling an IED that's near me. Like, so basically I have a 40 meter bubble around me and my guys, so we can walk through this town and you can text explode to the bomb and it won't go through until I've already passed it. Right. So the it's like an IED shield because it's using EW, and you can get that synced up with your radios, so like it's jamming the entire spectrum minus what your radio's on as your radio frequency hops around on a preset like hop schedule that every other radio has on a crypto load. That is a known, you know, I'm not giving like a secret technology, that's a thing the US has, but like that's a order of magnitude less complex than like flying a drone, right? And even that right.
Say nothing of guiding a hypersonic missile, right?
Yeah. The when EW is up, it's up. And also, like, if they're doing it and you don't, like, say like you're the Ukrainians and the Russians start pumping a bunch of EW and you didn't make plans to use drones or even radios, maybe like there's no you should try to start pumping out whatever too, because if they cut it off, you better if you're getting hit with EW and then the Russians cut it off, you better start pumping your own up really quick, because that means they're sending drones at you, right? So like it's just like it's a good way to model it. I've never played Combat Mission Black Sea, but that's that sounds about right for how it would work eventually. One thing I think is not modeled is how relatively low range these thing systems are. Like it, the and how like.
Well, the, your spotter quad. I still haven't. I've only like dicked around on like the lowest difficulty setting with like the smallest maps because I'm really. I do actually want to learn. I think it's just going to be a very good tool for understanding at a tactical level how this is being fought. But the spotter UAVs do have a very limited radius. It's really not much at all. They can't just like go and it's not like a multi. I mean, you can play multiplayer, but they even do like multiplayer by email. And I'm not intending this as an advertisement for, but I, but yeah, no, it's not the kind of thing where you need for like quote unquote gameplay mechanic reasons, to be able to, you know, light up an arbitrary plot, grid point on the map. I mean, there's like a sliding scale, obviously, of realism, but the, that's not actually a part of it from what I understand. If you can fly UAVs for observation, they have to be basically right near you. So there you go.
Well, no, I was referring to the EW being close to you, like
the actual that's for the whole battle. That's like when you like set up the, you know, you get ready, get a certain number of points, you decide, you know, which map you're going to be on, how big it is, blah, 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 you know, weather conditions. And EW is essentially a weather condition. It's in that like category of like when you're loading the map.
So, yeah, that's interesting. That's something I'm more, I kind of want to bring up the drone thing, but like you'll notice that like, it's not that big a deal anymore. Like I think everybody's kind of adjusted to it. Like, maybe you don't. It seems like the actual, also because Bakhmut's over, but like the actual like getting, you know, two grenades dropped on you, you know, is shitty. And I think people have kind of adapted. Like every game changing tactic gets adapted to very quickly. And yes. I think there's much less footage of like a lot of the footage coming out of it is now it's Orlans spotting for Lancets. Or whatever. It's not.
I don't know how to pronounce it either, but yes.
Yeah. And those are much more serious, much more high flying systems. Both of those, I think either EW has gotten so common that everyone's got it up just to stop enemy, you know, getting dropped on, or people have just tightened up. Like, I think it's also very possible. I have no idea how to confirm this, but that instead of doing like traditional like 2-man observation posts that would just get, you know, spot from the air with thermals and dropped a grenade on, that guys are being, there's probably less distribution of those kind of observation posts, and people are more tight to a position that has EW defense, because it doesn't seem like, I think everyone kind of realizes in the war that like the you don't actually need to guard every single point of everything. You can kind of, you know, use like a more elastic defense. And you know, if two guys get behind your lines, it's really not that big a deal. And I think the old Warsaw Pact doctrine was kind of very much obsessed with like not letting people behind your lines to cause chaos, and B, doing that to everybody else.
Remember like, DRGs?
Yeah, DRGs. And I think everyone realized that shit doesn't really matter like at all. It's just a couple guys. You know, it's basically. Also, you burn off your most motivated, best trained guys doing that. Like, you're like cool Spetsnaz 10-man team with their silenced pistols and rifles and thermobaric RPGs that would like get in close and destroy an enemy general. It's like, well, an enemy colonel or like battalion commander is pretty fucking replaceable, right? But those 10 Spetsnaz guys are probably worth like those 10 Spetsnaz guys, assuming if you made them all like squad leaders of a Russian force, probably are more useful to the Russians than like any one Ukrainian battalion commander and his staff, which are like seemingly extremely replaceable because, you know, they're getting burned relatively quickly. So I think both sides have not agreed to stop using DRGs. You're still going to see the concept and. But I think they'll become more much closer to like how NATO uses just scouts than this kind of thing where you're like Also, EW makes it a lot harder to go deep behind enemy lines if, like, your radios just don't work anymore.
EW and just reconnaissance generally, especially satellite. I mean, that's another kind of big qualitative difference from really any. I mean, certainly it's not like you had GPS satellites and constant real time eyes in the sky in the Vietnam War. You know, even for most of the Cold War, the best you got was that was like why we had U2s, right? Was high quality cameras. You could get a bird in the air, basically the border between the atmosphere and outer space, taking photographs and get them back, you know, within a couple hours. That's, you know, there's no need for that because now you get more or less continuous real-time monitoring just with satellites. And yes, we talked a little bit about this before. I do think that the I don't know if Russia has launched more satellites. I know they have flown missions. I don't know that to ostensibly civilian missions. I don't know that they've increased like the number of satellites or if they've improved the way that the existing satellites worked or what exactly. It's hard to say, but it does seem that the surveillance and reconnaissance, whether it may not even be satellites, maybe they just improved terrestrial capabilities. It's really just impossible to say, and maybe we'll never know. But certainly it seems that they there's very little happening in along the line of contact and even behind it, even in far western Ukraine, that Russian command is not in some way aware of, which did not seem to be the case earlier, at least subjective. I don't know, do you agree? Do you notice that kind of difference?
Yeah, Russian intel is definitely better for sure than it used to be at the beginning. They're not doing stupid things, they're doing smart things, it seems. They're hitting enemy supply dumps that I'm sure have been there since the beginning. I don't think that there weren't, you know, comparable dumps before every other offensive in Kherson and Kharkiv. I definitely think that something. I don't know if it's they've actually finally gotten like some line to defectors in the Ukrainian staff or really? Whatever, or they have, or they've had, you know, XYZ just, you know, sympathize.
Yeah, this could be human intelligence, not anything.
I would even argue it's more like, because like the satellite stuff hasn't changed much. Like I see no reason, nothing, you know. Have they assigned more analysts to satellite stuff? Yeah. I doubt it.
Right.
You know, if they didn't have that already going 100% in the from day one, they were stupid. I think there's obviously some improvement. I think they're more confident in their ability to strike targets. For sure. It seems to be
the AD net is degraded significantly. Yeah. Right. So that, you know, these things work hand in hand for sure. Yeah, well, certainly overall, observing this, one of the things that I've noticed really, yes, over the past 72 hours is quite a lot of dooming from, appropriate dooming, but still from the, I've seen something I would see in kind of dribs and drabs before, but now it's a stream and it's becoming a torrent of people who are saying, like, because there's still some copers, but they're being challenged from other hoholtards who are saying, like, I really wish it was true, that I really wish I could believe, you know, what the Ukrainian MOD is saying. Because when they say, like, we shot down 12 missiles and there's, you know, grainy footage on the other side of an explosion that may or may not have been a hit or a miss, and they say it's a miss, and you get punished if you say otherwise on social media. Yeah, there's more room for coping. But when you see, as we saw just really, you know, in the last 24 hours, woke up this morning and there was fresh footage of Leopard 2s on fire. That's a new development. B, that's really not supposed to happen. I mean, people say, like, oh, well, there's always going to be losses. Like, yeah, but this is an entire, I mean, the some of the footage is like of seems to be actually rear areas. There were some people asking questions like, why are these tanks bunched up so closely. What I saw, don't know if it's true or not, but in a way, I hope for Ukrainian's sake that this is true. It's not that they were advancing at the front on the, directly at the front on in bunched up so close. This was an assembly area. This was they were massing, and they got found and hit. And yeah, so there's just a lot of not yet the gory footage. It's mostly the just the tanks,
Orlan,
tank on fire.
It's just Orlan footage outside town.
200 meter up footage of tanks on fire outside town, and lots of tanks in lots of fire. And yeah, it's brutal. It does seem to be. Well, I think to me the telling, the telling thing is CNN is not coping with. I mean, a little bit. They're trying to say, oh, but they're not even really saying like Russia in Bakhmut. They kept making this big deal out of Russia is taking all these casualties, which, I mean, I guess maybe. I mean, who knows? But it doesn't seem Yes, it was bloody for sure on both sides, but it was probably quite a bit more bloody on 1.5 times ish on the Ukrainian side. This is like, I don't know. We're back in that kind of like 5-10 maybe more times bloodier on the Ukrainian side than the Russian side.
I do question how many people are actually dying in these. Like a lot of one thing I think that the Ukrainians have done, like the reason Ukrainian math is so, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why Ukrainian math is bad on the way when they say how many Russians have died, is because like they'll look at a Russian BMP die that's blown out. And
yeah,
say that was
well, that's 8 guys or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, the whole crew and thing would be 10 guys. So we'll say 2 escaped and it's 8 guys. I wonder how many, like these, because these are pretty heavily armored vehicles, mostly hitting mines and getting artillery shells. I wonder how many, like, actual bodies are being lost.
It's a good question.
Also, how many of these vehicles are, like, irrecoverable? Which they're on fire, but they're not, like, blown the fuck out, you know?
Yes.
So like,
and there's a lot you can do for a vehicle that's not totally destroyed.
Yeah, especially if you can send it to Poland. If you can do that off-site and in another country.
And generally, the attacker gets to do that more than the defender for kind of obvious reasons.
Yes, and that's why I want to bring up this point that I don't think this I don't think this means that manpower is missing in next siege, you know, we're all in edge of our seats for the next season of Commie Block Siege, you know, Eastern Europe. And I don't know where they're going to take it for the next season. It could be there's like 3 or 4 good candidates.
Avdeevka are the.
I think Avdeevka is the most politically whatever, and Chasovyar is the most military whatever. I mean, sure. How you want to. Because Avdeevka needs to be taken for like, because like it's the last
that's
place.
That's where they're shelling Donetsk from. Still,
that's the last pocket. Place you can ship, and there you can use conventional artillery to shell the capital of the DPR. It's a major smack in the face to their legitimacy that even can happen. But either way, I don't think this weakens. Like, had you taken these troops and vehicles and reassigned them into a, you know, next siege, I don't think it would be very meaningful. I don't, or like the losses aren't going to hurt them. And also, I want to point out that I think that this war has destroyed. Hold on.
Sorry. No. Go on. Go on.
Yeah. This war has destroyed one of the oldest and I appreciate it. Cold War mean that I assumed was true, and I appreciated that armored vehicles could be dug in to create like a super pillbox because it's like dirt. It's like a man or trench is hard to kill.
Oh yeah, and really in Company Heroes, it's like a dig. I fuck with the
dig in your tanks.
Company of Heroes 3 is like a you can you just dig in your tank and it's a big important mechanic. Yeah,
it's super hard to kill, and you can dig in your and so like a person's hard to kill, so a tank dug in is double hard to kill, and I think this war has kind of unfortunately because I liked that meme, I trained a lot of that meme. That might not be true at all. Because, like, if we're just going to be sitting outside of, you know, in these trenches, plastered with artillery, an immobile tank is just going to get, like...
It's just going to get that many more Lancet strikes.
It's going to catch a shitload around us. And I think you get this weird thing where you actually... It's useful to have them for the elastic defense, but actually, like, any civilian vehicle can be used to transport your troops in the elastic defense element of it, right?
Because they're hull just moving down. Around. Yeah, that's the ability in Company Heroes, hull down.
Yeah.
It was a doctrinal ability in Company Heroes 2, and it's a non-doctrinal. Wehrmacht tanks can just, or the Panzer IVs. Yeah. I think also, anyway, they can just hull down and ruin and infantry's day all day.
And I think I think we don't see any of that for a reason. I think it's because you just get hit with anything, right? If you just have a very big fat target, especially on these long static fronts, and I don't think it's going to be it's a big deal for the Russians or the Ukrainians to lose all these APCs, and I don't think the Russians' big APC and tank advantage is going to show much, because this is fundamentally an artillery and infantry war. And I don't think this changes anything. If anything, it kind of reifies that this is actually a light infantry war, and that like the times that armor has gotten to do some cool stuff, it's been punished very heavily. And we're kind of back. I don't know. It's very cliche to say we're back into World War One, bro, guys. But
well,
like kind
of well, drones have negated a lot of
And so ATGMs and mines have like you've made it to where armored cavalry, what you would call that. Is where cavalry was in World War One. So it's not that it's not
no,
that,
that
it's
is
ineffective.
A spicy take. No,
that and it's not that it's utterly take. Ineffective. It's not that it's utterly ineffective. Yeah. It's just become hyper situational, much shorter extremely range dangerous. Than people had hoped. Yeah. And when it works effectively, it still takes heavy losses.
And yeah, you know, much more dangerous than it used to be for the people in the cavalry.
So the argument, like you know, time is a flat circle, blah blah blah, you know. And I think, like tank, if they're still like it's tanks are very situational. They just became uber situational again. Like it used to be that it was always better to be or to have on your side the, you know, the SS Panzer or the Third Armored or the First Armored or all the any of these American or like all these famous tanker units. Like it was almost always like oh god oh fuck.
Well, tanks were always better. I mean, you know, tank tanks division. Always had trouble fighting in forested
but it was,
areas.
But it was always better to have a tank division than not have one, right?
Yeah.
And now it's almost not like if you're, true. Yeah. It's almost even money. Like, and I think you see that because there's no more tank divisions, right? Even both sides are using. They're using separate tank battalions. It's like this is the
funny,
whatever.
Funny story about that. So I was trying to put together a kill list or just like looking at you know I was trying to like doing my OSINT whatever. Bit and trying to compile sources of information and look at okay so and it's of course you know the command structures are going to be opaque probably forever but it was noteworthy that there was a large degree of agreement on the fact that on this the first big nighttime tank battle of the 21st well the first big tank battle of the 21st century and the first it was a nighttime battle Ukraine sent something like 100, 120, maybe a few more, but probably in that range of tanks. And still not clear exactly. Definitely probably about half at least were immobilized at least. But it was like, okay, so I was trying to think, okay, well, is this because on paper that's like two armored brigades, but it doesn't look like they fought as two armored battalions. It doesn't seem that they fought as like this is an armored battalion doing just an armored push. It seems like they're attached to this other. They're not doing this classical. We're not going to do like just an armored formation pushing just as an armored formation, from what I'm seeing. But it's really hard to say.
Yeah, it seems like the like I don't want to say the Cav Scouts are right because they're. Not the cringe in the U.S. military, but like they, it's almost just like anything with armor, any armored vehicle, is kind of like, it's almost like the old. Actually, it's not the SS. So the SS was a little back goes back that the SS was cheating at one point in World War II. But there was like the internally there were like tabs of who had more tank kills, and the SS created a category of like armor. That was not just tanks. It was, you know, tanks and like anything with a little bit of armor on it that wasn't like between a truck and a tank, right?
Yeah.
To juice the numbers. And like, you know, we're kind of in that zone where like actually anything that's a little bit armored is kind of, they're all useful in this like you want to call it, like armored cavalry or shock cavalry role, where they just push. And like, it doesn't seem to me that, like, you know, watching these things fight, that there's that much difference in terms of, you know, anything between how a tank. Now, if tanks will shrug off bigger hits for sure, but it doesn't seem like that's there's much of a difference between like watching a convoy that's mixed and like the tanks are getting hit and the BMPs are getting hit and the Max Pro trucks are getting hit and the Humvees are all getting hit. Like, it's like they've created this, we've created this kind of like category of vehicle that like it will stop small arms bullets, it'll stop bullets and nothing else.
Yeah.
And it's almost like that tank gun seems to be like the, if like were I the, so like if I was the US military, I was in this war, the US military will always design a vehicle like that's hyper specific, like the what do you call it? I'm losing it.
The MRAP.
The MRAP, yeah, like it's just a pure vehicle that only gets for getting, it's for getting IED and nothing else.
Right, right.
If I was designing like this conflict's version of the MRAP, which they, no one should like, no side would be sort of making like a, it would be literally like a tank with no gun that just holds dudes. Maybe like it's got like a ATGM on it or something like that. But like you just need like a, you need the toughness of a tank and it just deliver, it delivers guys. You know, like the gun.
ABC? I don't
know. Like with tank, with tank tier armor, like in theory, like if I was designing like hyper specific for the, just this conflict, because it seems like you need to deliver your assault infantry really close.
Yes. You need to get the guys in the trenches, but they need to get to the trenches and your main gun may have some, well, the thing, at least on the Russian side, it seems like the main guns are being mostly used for fire support. Like they're not,
well, they on both sides, especially like it's like these tank fights are getting more and more uncommon. And like, I think I'm not even meaning like if, especially when they, cause these things are very, these tank fights, you know, relatively close quarters, you know, they're not like hitting at max range. A la like, you know, the other storm, that if I was a tank and I could like disgorge a couple of guys with ATGMs,
right,
that would be more effective than like a tank gun. It seems like they could get higher, they could get into buildings, they could do stuff, you know.
If you could deliver a couple javelins within a couple hundred meters of a tank, that's probably, I would be curious to see the numbers if that, you know, but I would, from what I've seen,
you,
it would,
yeah, how yeah, you simulate that.
But it would probably be more effective than trying to down that tank with your main gun, probably.
Yeah, and it seems like everyone agrees. Like, also, the Russians, like, I think Grant's too, like, the USSR was very much right in that, like, tanks don't need to carry that much ammo. Like, Russian tanks don't carry, in their autoloader, I think it's 24 or 36, I didn't know the model, but, like, they don't carry that many rounds in the gun. And I think they're pretty vindicated on that like, we're not seeing these tank duels that of any length, and things like the, like a BMP is just better for infantry support, right? Because you have a smaller gun, you can carry more ammunition, and that's what matters. And
see BMP, I mean, it's some of that gory footage, some of the goriest is of BMPs against infantry on foot, right? Like, then that's which what they're there for. Yeah. So, yeah. So, yeah, and I think the big picture, you're absolutely right, and we've also discussed this before, but is that there's not, tactics is kind of an arms race, and especially between these essentially peer level militaries, where it's not, you know, there's not really a clear cut technological advantage. You know, Russia has technologically superior missiles, US NATO has other, you know, I guess technological advantages, especially in the kind of information space. But, you know, it at a certain level, it's kind of a wash. I mean, you know, Russia has satellites and intelligence assets, and US, NATO have missiles and missile defense.
Oh, have I, so, before we get into like the kind of wrapping it up, have I done my
I don't know if I was necessarily wrapping it. Well, I guess we should, but yeah, I'm
sorry. Yeah, there. Have I done my take on the podcast where the Cold War didn't happen?
No, go on.
Because I think I told you this, you know, before, like, there's this concern that the Ukrainians will run out of ammo.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah, right.
Have I done this on a podcast? That earlier. Yeah, have I done this on a podcast yet? Because I feel like
we can refresh our audiences.
Yeah,
no, go on.
There's always been this persistent take from the, you know, the Scott Ritter of the world that the U.S., the Western industrial complex cannot keep up in terms of production with the use rate in Ukraine. That is, I think, by and large true, but it forgets the fact that there are the stockpiles of U.S. and NATO spec shells are vast and deep, and even if they've been sold off to, you know, little other countries or like South Korea or African countries or Brazil, the Cold War didn't happen, and both sides spent 40 to 50 years making 155 millimeter shells, and all these and the Ukrainians, yes, are using them very quickly, but we're never going to see there will never be a time when the Ukrainians aren't firing back. It's just not going to happen. There's plenty of shells. There's enough, right? Obviously, they don't have as many as they want, but that's not the same as them running out. I think that's a big deal to make, because people, I think, have this idea that, well, Ukraine is just going to be out, and that's just not true. Like, there will always be, there are depots in Africa, yeah, South America,
right,
East, all Southeast over the world, Asia.
Literally. I mean, they've already tapped, to some extent, the Israeli, I don't know if they, I'm sure Israel has additional.
And also, I've noticed a little more presence of, I guess they're all howitzers in the Napoleonic sense, but light or not light between 105 mil. Like you've seen other guns. Like those aren't even nearly tapped. I don't think there's plenty of 105 millimeter stuff. Like Ukraine will have stuff as long as this war's going. Absolutely, and like
they will not run out of artillery shells or warm bodies. They have already run out of Eastern System air defense missiles. They're going to be on a strictly rationed diet of HIMARS and other.
With HIMARS, I think it's more of information. Like,
yeah,
they have plenty of HIMARS missiles or. It's they don't
they have enough have, to for they have enough for they have
yeah
yes I they get have, what you're saying
they have enough for okay. all of their targets they don't have targets like
they don't have aircraft but the aircraft are, I don't think that would really move the needle. I mean they would need a lot of they would need more aircraft than anybody.
It's impossible. They would need you would need to destroy the Russian air defense systems, ground based air defense systems in contested airspace. Which is just like,
yeah, it's just,
you would need 100, you would need 200.
I don't even know that. No, probably more like 3 or 4. But even then, it's like,
I mean, you would need to outnumber the Russians, which is
yes,
like, you know,
and Russia has thousands, and you know, and the U.S. There's a lot of F-16s are out there too, but
the price of an F-16 is much higher than the price of
yes.
Artillery,
yeah, and you need to train for a long time, and you need, you know, there's also like maintenance issues, and you need F-16 there was a great thread on Twitter by a former aircraft mechanic who serviced F-16s, and I learned a lot, including that which makes a lot of sense, that the, you know, NATO doctrine with F-16s presumes you're either taking off from a carrier or from some equivalently very nice flat surface, that there are basically constant rotations of maintenance personnel checking the ground for debris, because the F-16 intakes are, there's only one set and they're very low to the ground. So any, like a single like nut or screw that gets in there is going to, could just ruin, I mean, that could be a dead pilot. The Russian aircraft, which is a completely different doctrine, that assumes you're going to be more often than not in real world combat conditions, you're going to be taking off from some Central European grass field. So you need to be able to deal with mud, with dirt and shit, for literal, you know, cow feces in your intake. So what they have are, especially for conditions that require it, an extra set of intakes on the top of the airframe. So the wings are like physically blocked. They're essentially a giant filter, physically blocking whatever needs to get blocked, so that you can take off from less than ideal runways. And it's not even just like because it's obviously the pilot training and the maintenance training and the maintenance logistical pipeline and the manufacturing of the parts and all that kind of stuff, but it's also just the physical design of the, I mean, the whole doctrine. I mean, essentially it's, you know, the NATO doctrine presupposes a giant carrier fleets off the coast of whatever bumfuckistan or whatever it is that you're going to be pounding.
I'll have to read this thread, but I think he's pushing it.
Could be.
Like, it seems such an imminently solvable problem. Like,
which part?
The single nut or piece of gravel, because like flight lines aren't that neat, you know. Like, I don't know.
I could be falling for the. Well, he was a pro-Ukrainian guy, but I could be falling for the version of like the. You know how I know Russian logistics suck? Look at these tank. Look at these tires. Look at these tires. Look at the. Oh, yeah. Look at the how these the condition of these tires. That's how I know Ukraine is going to win. I could
but
be
like as a wannabe engineer, I have like immediate like, well, you could design like a filter, because all you need to do is get the plane in the air, right? So you could have some kind of filter that just pops off after you get it in the air. Like, that just it just
yeah,
seems...
I mean, it could be an engineering, it could be a solvable engineering problem. That's
or like also like how much, I don't know, I'm getting too much of like, I don't know enough of jet engines, but like the intakes, they don't. Like, things that go in the intakes come out very quickly, right? Like, there's, it's like a, the intake to like getting pushed at the back, there's not too much going on there. Like, that's like an engine. You're adding pressure to the, but yeah, I don't know.
These are just extremely, which does fit with what, at least what I know of, just how the United States has kind of designed its whole military industrial apparatus, is it's extremely tight tolerances for the engines. It's not even so much, it's like, essentially the issue would be with that would be timing. It would mess with the timings and that would eventually cause a catastrophic failure. Could be bullshit, I don't know, but
I just feel like that's always a concern. Like, there's no way, like, there's not some engineer doing that math, like, because also the F-16 isn't an air superiority fighter, it's multi-role, so it's, you would expect, you know, not necessarily like perfect intercept. It's not an intercept.
Well, it's
a utility.
All of this is hypothetical because it doesn't, because yeah. they're not going to send, there's not going to be 1,000 F-16s in Ukraine. Yeah. It's just not going to happen. So it kind of doesn't matter. I think what's indisputably true is that the doctrinal framework for the development of these airframes were quite different, and maybe, you know, it's a solvable engineering problem. It could well be, but these things are like Soviet equipment is notorious for being okay, maybe not certainly not as technologically advanced in certain ways, but and maybe not, maybe equivalently or even less reliable in certain ways, but very rugged and very easily serviceable, the kinds of service that would be done the doctrine is framed around a kind of like fighting in the mud, versus fighting in nice clean surfaces in the air, and in the water, that sort of defines American military doctrine or has up to this point. And I just have a hard time imagining that wouldn't at some level play out, were this to happen. But yeah, again, it's just not.
I do have one more big picture thing I want to talk about to kind of shift gears.
Yeah.
There's been like, even last night, I think it was overblown. There's not been a lot of night fighting.
And no. Yeah.
You can tell that because night footage is impressive and vague. So both sides would love to play with them, because you can just say like, you know, Russian tank.
Look at me
kills.
Blowing up this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, it's totally inconclusive, but like, both sides have enough night vision. There's plenty of night vision that was pushed out of all this thing, and it's built into these vehicles, and you're just not seeing it. And that indicates it is hard to fight at night. Like, it is very hard. And both sides kind of agree to avoid it. And also because like the friendly fire concerns are hot, or very high. Yeah. But also it could also be that I don't know. Like I said, I don't know how heavy EW has been, but like EW also, you know, fucks with radios. Obviously, you know, it's way easier to fuck with radios than you know, you just put out garbage in the frequency, right? If you're going to do night stuff, you would need a lot of radios talking to each other, right? A lot of communication over radio.
Sure. So,
and if like the enemy just decides to flip on their EW thing because they see like you're doing a night mission and you're flying some drones overhead to support your night mission, enemy flips on their jammer just to fuck with your drone, and then you can't talk anymore. And you're trying to coordinate this night mission. Like the whole point of it is to be stealthy and quiet, and now you're, you know, yelling and you know shouting. You know, I think it's very possible that we don't see any much fighting very far away from like major railways or highways.
Yeah.
That it's daytime, you know, fighting for most of these guys. And I'm sure there's raids and like, you know, the equivalent of trench raids and all that stuff. But I think a lot of it is going to be, it's mostly in the day. And that's for obvious reasons. It's easier to, it's like,
yeah, well, the big, the night battle that we were talking about that just happened.
Didn't seem much like a battle. It was like they were moving through a minefield and didn't move through a minefield anymore.
Right. And there were, it was preceded and followed by daytime battles. And we'll, I guess I'll have to see, currently as we're recording, it's nighttime in the Ukraine, and there's word that I guess what would be the third wave has commenced. So we'll see. But yeah, it's at a minimum doesn't seem, it's not even for these kind of big, maybe especially for these kind of big pushes or attempted big pushes, it's like night is at best equal today, and yeah, overall it certainly seems I guess the one difference, and this is kind of falls in that trench raid category, is supposedly what you would hear Ukrainian soldiers complain about was getting outclassed by Wagner at night in the urban environment, especially in Bakhmut, but I think also in Soledar. And that does seem like if you're talking like a relatively small scale engagement in a confined building where, you know, probably even during the day you could have visibility issues, it makes a certain amount of sense.
Yeah. And the other thing is that everyone has night vision because of the UAVs. Like thermals are, if they're not the base model, but like any above base model on a DJI, I think most of them have thermals. So like thermals have, even if true IR NVGs are still kind of not super propagated, thermals are just everywhere. And everyone has, and thermals are also like way easier to use than traditional IR. Green NVGs require some like training time and some getting used to. Whereas thermals just
also thermals really just work. Retarded. I mean, the good ones, retarded expensive.
Yeah. I am surprised. I don't know. Like the DJI drones, like, they're called off the shelf. They're still kind of pricey. They're like, you know, $2,000 or whatever. But I am surprised how affordable like those thermals are. Like they have, I mean, you don't want to say, well, like they were always intended to be military. Like the DJI Mavic drone product was like a military product from Jump Street, which it might have been, but I do doubt. But that is probably the most affordable way to get like thermals, like a comparable thermal scope to a DJI drone's thermals. Costs about the same as the DJI drone, just the scope, you know. So
yep,
I'm very, it's a little suspect, isn't it? You know, like, but also it's easier to do thermals it's apparently somewhat easier to do with like a camera than a scope because you don't have to deal with there's less. I don't know the exact mechanics of it, but scopes have to. The biggest thing is that scopes have to be like recoil proof, you know, and so there's a lot of toughening in a. A military thermal or a hunting thermal has to recoil. Whereas your DJI Mavic doesn't have to, it can be
doesn't
much more
have to deal with that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but
interesting. All right. Yeah. Well, that should be enough for now. And I think it'll be nice to record it somewhat more frequently if we can't, it seems like we're back on a more frequent schedule.
Yeah.
We're going to have Alex McNabb soon for BattleTech, which is going to be fun. MechWarrior. Which is going to be fun. And then, yeah, we can, seems like after that kind of brutal slog of Bakhmut, Soledar, that for at least for the next, for the immediate future, things are moving somewhat quickly again. So we'll see. But well, I think that I don't know that once the combat power of this strike package has been exhausted, it's an interesting question. Will Russia immediately counterattack, or will they resume a kind of slow grind? But I think that's kind of how I see this shaping up to the, for like the short, for the next, I don't know, 5-6 months ish is like this, you know, this counteroffensive doesn't seem like it's going to take, or whatever offensive is, we'll see, I guess. But for now, it looks like it's burning up its power quite quickly without a whole lot to show for it. And you know, how much is going to be available for reserve, for defense, for and what the Russian command is going to decide as far as when and where to strike, or how, or whether they're just going to continue doing the, you know, grid by grid. Okay, now we blow this apartment block up. Okay, now we blow that apartment block up. Okay, now we repeat this 300 times, and now we've taken Chasiv Yar. Or whether they're, you know, who knows? I guess it's a, what do you think?
I think it's going to be there. I think it's going to be a Divka or Chasiv Yar. It's going to be another Bakhmut. We will just be, I don't think there will ever be, like, I don't think at any point there's going to be big armor breakout, you know, big arrows. Yeah. I think at absolute best, it's kind of my picture of the end of the conflict. You get that end of World War One thing on the Western Front, where you have this brief return to kind of a quasi maneuver, and the casualties go way up, but like everyone knows it's the end anyway, and it's not like no position that was taken at the end of World War One was held, and you know, like these things are like, perhaps you'll see at the end of this conflict a lot more maneuvering for ground and some kind of peace talks, but I think the Ukrainians can hold on for, I think I made the, you know, probably another year, maybe two, at current rates of expenditure and lives lost.
That seems more. I said this before. I'll say this
again. The Russians can do it too.
Yeah. Oh, the Russians can. I think they have it longer than that. But
and also, you know, the Russians have, if the Russians were willing to start taking major cities and like spend the lives to take, you know, Kharkiv.
They're going to have to do it for Kharkov at a minimum. I mean, the problem now is that Kharkov is like, they can do the Avdiivka to Donetsk bit from Kharkov into Belgorod, essentially. And like, that's not acceptable. Like, the minimum they're going to have to do that.
Yeah. Like, at some point, there will have to be a big arrow on a map, but I don't think it's going to be very big. I think it's possible that they'll have made the decision that, okay, now we have to do a big bloody push that's fast to knock out Kharkov, but that'll probably be like one of the few. And maybe I could see this ending at the Dnieper. And
I think that's still the mode nigga outcome. It's just the question is sort of there's a lot of, you know, questions that would go along with that. And I think that could work.
The Poles could intervene and that comes to wild card is like,
well, the problem is that like Russia would totally be willing to accept the Dnieper as an international border. The problem is number one, Western Ukraine, and number two, like what's the, even more than that, what is the diplomatic status? Like Russia would be willing to accept a belt, like the quote unquote, the nation state of Ukraine, possibly deprived of its Western territories, which would be reintegrated with Poland. And you have this tiny little rump state between the Carpathians and the Dnieper that's called on a map the nation state of Ukraine, and it has its currency and everything and a seat at the UN, and it's totally real, guys. But it's basically Belarus. Like that would be acceptable, I think, to Russia. I think
so with that country, but it's hostile. Like
that I don't think would be acceptable.
I think they would accept hostile, but not in NATO.
Well, maybe, but like then we're gonna. The problem is there's gonna be voices.
We're gonna do it again in 20 years.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I think this war ends and we do it again. We're in the Balkans. This war ends and we do it again. I mean, we're not in the Balkans, but
you know, I understand what you mean.
We're right there. Like we're gonna get really good at having this war. Like, you know,
if that's the outcome, then it's just gonna be this war again in 20 years for sure.
Yeah, probably, absolutely. And I think the Russians will be in a relatively strong position Western Europe will be in.
Yeah. Like, and certainly like United Serbia. States, you imagine the United States 20 years from now trying to do this bit? Holy dude, shit, yeah.
Like, I think you might see the Serbs start acting up.
Already are. Yeah.
Yeah. Who knows? You know, I don't think, you know, I think that, you know, Russia has time on its side in more ways than one in like the long term or the short term. I think like, you know, in 20 years when there's like a Chinese peace conference over this, the Russians get most of what they want, you know, like if there's a Chinese led peace conference at the UN in 20 years, cause they're the new thing, you know, power.
I think it's pretty clear, and maybe we can close with this. I think it's pretty clear that this, like, I've been developing this take for a while, and I think it's fully formed enough to say that this is, we are essentially renegotiating the structure of the United Nations Security Council, which is the winner's table at World War II. You know, the order set up at Yalta is crumbling. The whole, like, it's noteworthy, you know, obviously Russia and China are highly militarized. France never demilitarized. The United Kingdom did. And they're playing this like pipsqueak, you know, manlet incel character on the world stage. And it's extremely embarrassing for them to essentially be the little, you know, the little manlet trying to get their big retard, you know, the retard empire to land the big hits for them. But, you know,
the entire United Kingdom Department of Defense could be transported with all its equipment and stores into Lviv, and this war wouldn't change.
No, not even a little bit. Yeah.
So, like,
so the idea that UK deserves to be on the United Nations Security Council, leaving it, like, whether, you know, maybe Germany, you know, I don't think anyone in the Western powers at this point would have a problem with Germany taking their place, but it's not so much about that. It's more like what that signals in terms of I don't believe there's any structure really for the, or maybe there is, but it would require essentially unanimous consent from all parties.
I think the actual thing is less grand, and that we're renegotiating 1982. Like,
maybe somewhere in between.
It's kind of cliche. We're bringing back the Soviet Union. You know, now there's a, it's the combined China and US and Russia can now has an equal vote to what the US does. We're back to where we were kind of.
Well, that much is certainly true. Yes, there's the military aspect, but it's also Bretton Woods, which, okay, essentially got, we left Bretton Woods, but in a way, like, when Bretton Woods went away, Bretton Woods being essentially the system of reserve currency as it existed from 1945 to 1977, was it? Or 70, I forget. I think it was Nixon who left. Doesn't really matter. With the United States not only left the gold standard, but essentially said, no, we're just doing MMT now. And dollars and gold have no necessary relationship to each other whatsoever. And neither does dollar to pound or anything else. All that did was accelerate and solidify the process of the United States becoming the global reserve currency and just the unit of international trade, which isn't going away anywhere anytime soon. But on that kind of 20-year timeline, we're talking about China now negotiating like the actual resolution of this conflict potentially. I think when you're, that's where I start, like, it's not just about like how many divisions can the UK field. It's like, what is the structure of the quote unquote international order? And that I do see change, you know, maybe it may not changes, or maybe you're right that it was, you know, we're setting the clock back to 1992 instead of 1945, but it seems to me inevitable that we're on a course to renegotiate that 1945, that on that grand of a scale, the international order. Could be wrong in a way. Yeah, I hope I am, but
yeah, no, it'd be cool, it'd be really cool if we were doing, you know,
if Germany became cooler if you did,
yeah, of course, but I don't think, you know, I just think now it's like, actually, we're going to let – it happened before the war even started, but like, actually, no, now Russia Russia gets to do military adventurism if they want to in Africa as a treat, and so does – and China gets to do their own, you know, commie IMF thing, and everyone just – like, that would have been unheard of, you know, in the Obama presidency, but now we get to – like, those are things that were pre-1991. Yeah, the Chinese and the USSR, they're doing like – Soviet friendship loans, and now they're doing like Belt and Road loans, and like it used to be, we're sending Soviet slash Cuban advisors to Africa, and now we're sending Wagner. Like, we're just back at, and we were, it was before the war had started, but like now I think we're just kind of making it official that, you know, we're back at, you know, it's not like multipolarity. It's kind of a meme. It's just like, it's back at like the duopoly again, where it's just, the duopoly requires the US and China to,
the Russian Cold War. Yes. The new Cold War.
Keep doing it, and maybe we get another Korean conflict. Who knows? Maybe we do something in the Philippines.
That would be fun.
Maybe we get a new Vietnam War. Maybe China reinvades Vietnam because
we got a new Cuban Missile Crisis in the offing. China's going to put a base in Cuba. So that's kind of funny. Maybe we'll get a Bay of Pig, another Bay of Pig. We're just doing the whole bit. Anyway,
I think also what Zog wants. Zog wants to do the bit again. Zog's probably really, really hyped to do the bit, and they can do Shining City on a Hill, you know, but fat, it's gay. Like Shining poppers in a gay club. I don't know. America has no needs. Like, if the only
Shining Tranny.
Right, yeah, the Shining Tranny on a Hill.
Shining Tranny in the library.
Yeah, but like America needs moral authority, and the only way they can do that is with money. Like, America's moral authority is derived from, like, we have more money, and, you know, we have, I think it's very possible we're just doing this over again. We're gonna do foreign policy realism again. You know, we're not gonna do make the world safe for democracy. Israel might even be de-emphasized. Like, I'm not even joking. Like, Israel will be.
I don't see any. Well, we'll. Yeah, who knows? I gotta run. I'm really sorry, but we will pick this up. I anticipate we'll have stuff to talk about in the war sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
So anyway, thanks everybody for listening. Take care, everybody.
See you.